woman that they could pay these, and they figured that he was worth it. And that was fine. There's no question on all of that. But where the problem came in was he got reimbursed for every dollar he spent. But he didn't tell Uncle Sam about that. He pocketed both. And somebody, I don't know how they learned, but they then came over and then started to investigate him. And they, I guess it was the not that, not that conference, but the next one, or 2 years after that, he had been investigated and tried, and they, he was convicted of a felony. Then again, here's a story that I was told, that I didn't, I can't verify personally that it was true, is that he was not sentenced yet. And the judge who presided over his trial, where he was convicted, was scheduled to meet with him and sentence him in an open court. And he said to him that he thought that George Parks had been penalized more than enough for what had happened to him. He said, when all of this started, you were a widely respected member of the scientific community. He said, people admired you and supported you. He said, today you have lost all that. I can't recommend any punishment that would be worse than what you've suffered. He said, I am not going to send you to prison. I think your life outside will be a sentence which is pretty rough. Now, I do know that George didn't go to prison. He was not sentenced to prison. But he, I guess, lived a couple of years after that when he died. But he was pretty sick at the time. The whole thing went on. And it was too bad. It was really, I feel, I liked him, even though he was an autocratic kind of character. And I didn't have any good connections to industry, so I couldn't give him any money. So I wasn't very important to him. But he was a guy who wanted to do what was best for science when he started. And he did it. He set up this whole thing. He got Alex and Irene to do the job. He hired them. They actually carried out the organization and stuff. Alex knew all about this thing when he took over from Parks. He knew a lot more than Parks did about how to operate it. And Alex, when he took this over, saved the conferences. There was a period when I think that they wanted to have somebody to go to talk to Parks and tell him that he had been relieved of his duties by board. And I said, I'm not going alone. I need some backup. And I said, I would further like to have back up somebody not on this board, somebody from industry who George respects. And somebody said, how about A.H. Batchelder? he's respected by everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, fine, if that's your recommendation, I'll call him and see if he will go with me to talk to George and Joe Kopic. And they suggested Joe Kopic, who was a research director at Texaco, bachelor at Standard Oil California, both big wheels in industry. And so I called up Batch. Oh, he said, Dr. Perry, I had never met him face to face. So I was still Dr. Perry to him. Dr. Perry, I've been a constant chairman, and he says, and a member of the board and a board chairman. He said, I've paid my dues. I said, please, this isn't an ordinary Gordon conference request. We have a situation where if this is not done right, these conferences will disappear. And he said, after I made that statement, he knew that there was something afoot that was very bad. He said, okay, you've convinced me. And he came and participated with me in seeing Parks, and it was very good because Parks couldn't say that the board or I had railroaded him, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Parks, Batchelder was of course as concerned as anybody else about what Parks had done, and he was then convicted.
Can you say a bit more about what the threat was to the conferences from Parks' personal IRS troubles?
The conferences didn't have any problem. As soon as Parks got out, then they weren't interested in the conferences.
How,
they weren't interested in the conference in the first place, but Parks told us
right,
they were.
Yes. Parks, I mean, obviously the industrial, the word presumably got back to other people in industry as to why Parks had been
removed. Oh, yeah. In fact, this thing was even written out in here.
But what was Parks's other strength in relation to the conferences beyond industrial fundraising? What else did he bring to the party?
Well, he brought Alexander Cruikshank and Irene Cruikshank. And they were loyal to him. I got that here. And he had the wisdom to use people properly. If Alex and Irene could do that, he said, you do it, and I won't try to direct you. That's what he brought.
Mm-hmm.
He knew how to be a good delegator.
Mm-hmm.
And he could make it go. He was a good administrator.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have been, here it says, he served as, we're talking about Alex. Alex started his PhD program at the University of Massachusetts in 1948, working as Parks' assistant. He was at Massachusetts, and he was then Parks' assistant. Parks was at Rhode Island. He served as Parks' assistant for 20 years. He and Irene had genuine affection and respect for Parks. And following Parks' resignation, Alex was fully in charge of the conferences, and he became chairman of those. But they liked him. He had directed a lot of Alex's early work.
Did Parks, did anyone know all the conference chairmen?
I don't think so. Well, I don't know, there was maybe 10 or 15 at that point. I don't know when it started to, well, it started to go wild, particularly wild in when Fred Basolo was a chairman, and he fought it tooth and nail.
He didn't want expansion.
He didn't want them to expand. He said that they're going to wreck it.
Because?
because you're taking in biologists and all of this kind of stuff.
Unwashed people.
Yeah, they'd unwashed, and he didn't want it. He said, these are fine conferences in the physical sciences, the emphasis mm-hmm. on that, and he didn't want to have the biologists take over. Well, they have taken over, but it hasn't done any damage, as near as I can see, to the other operation. Yes. But Fred fought that. He didn't like that.
What did Cruikshank bring to the party? I mean, he wasn't close to the industrialists. What did he offer?
Oh, he offered a lot. First, he was a native of New Hampshire. He could go out and talk to these guys that were running these schools, man to man. He knew what their finances were like. He knew what he could do, what he was doing for other schools, and they liked him as a person. And he could get away with keeping everything in line. He was a well-respected and well-loved person with the people he was doing business with. That was the first thing. Parks was always Dr. Parks to everybody who wasn't on his inner circle. And he would call them by their last name, doctor, or their last name, or sometimes if he had to, he'd say doctor this, doctor that. Alex was completely different. He was Alex to everybody. And he would go around to the schools and the meetings they had and Thursday night venues and stuff. And people loved to have him come. And people liked him. That's another thing he brought. And the last thing he brought was an appreciation of other people's contributions in all areas, raising money, controlling. One of the jobs that he had to do, and he needed help on sometimes, was trying to control people that got out of control. It seems silly to say that, but university professors were as bad as anybody else when they got liquored up. And he had some problems to do that, but he did it. He took the responsibility to do it, and everybody respected him for it. He didn't ever try to fight people or beat them up, but he did take action to control people, to keep the, well, what should we say, the decorum of the conferences where it should be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He did all those things, and he encouraged chairs to get money that permitted them to bring students and co-workers to conferences. And you know, when you find that the guy who's chairman got the money that brought you here, that was pretty good.
It really, somewhere in there's a real shift in the role of the chairman. I mean, a much more...
It was a gradual thing. It was a gradual thing, and he encouraged it. That's the thing. See, Parks didn't want to change it, but an Alex couldn't change it all of a sudden. He didn't have the resources. But he encouraged a gradual change. Now there has been a downside to that, too, in that now academe is in the dominance of the conferences and not industry. And now they're worrying about how they can get industry to participate more.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they worrying that? Just from a theoretical point of view?
No, because industry is a very large segment of the chemical profession. And it has a very important function in a society which is, well, like the industrial society.
Mm-hmm.
And they're worrying now, we don't want to get this thing just into an academic appreciation center. We want to try to interact with people in industry, help them if we can, get to know their people, have them get to know us and our people, and maintain a mutually desirable pattern. Mm-hmm.
This is what the board and senior debenture holders like yourself worry about. It's not necessarily what any particular chairman worries about.
Well, they're asked questions about this. I don't know if they worry about it, but they're asked questions about it. But if it's a conference where there's a sizable industrial activity and they try to make it an academic show, they will have to respond to some questions. For example, if the polymer conference had just a series of theoretical talks on polymerization, they would hear about it.
Who's minding the store?
They would hear about it from the board.
How would the board know?
They write these reviews. After every person who attends the conference gets an opportunity to write down his reviews. And there'd be a lot of people at the polymer conference who would be able to write their review, and if they said this was a bunch of theoretical gobbledygook which we didn't appreciate and didn't understand, the chairman hears about it. And that review also goes to the board of directors.
Mm-hmm. As I'm groping for the word, I've read about what assessors,
evaluators.
Yeah. Yes. Were they?
They have to be.
They were brought in at some stage.
Well, they're there all the time. Every conference.
No, but I mean, they weren't there in 1951, were they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were. Not in 51. I guess in 51 that was just the start. Nothing was set up very well in 51.
Well, they've been there for a long time.
But when I ran a conference, I knew who the guy, there was a man from the chairman's office, I mean the director's office, who was there evaluating my conference. His name was Helmut Handler.
Was he a... When you say a man from the director's office, a person? Or?
No, he was a professor at the University of New Hampshire.
An inorganic professor?
Right, and a very good man.
Who's going to write a confidential report, essentially,
right,
on whether Perry knows what he's doing.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
They had people like this, and these people didn't always write... glowing tributes.
And those reports went to the board?
They went to the board. Mm-hmm. They went to the scheduling and selection committee.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was bad enough, the selection committee would not schedule them for N years.
Mm-hmm.
There was a control.
Yeah. Let's go.
I need to run out to
Sorry.
The... Go
keep
ahead,
going.
Keep going.
Go, go,
just
go. Down the hall to the right, just before you get to the big hall.
Go to some of this. As board chair, what sort of demand on your time was that year of being board chair?
Well, that was a lot of my time, but that wasn't a normal year.
Yeah, okay. And being a board member in a normal year, it's essentially...
four or five meetings.
Yes.
Maybe three or four meetings.
Yes. And the meetings moved around the country with things like ACS meetings.
No, for the most part, these meetings were held in New York, or most of the board meetings used to be held in the Hotel Roosevelt in New York. And
a three-hour meeting, or a
sometimes it'd go a little longer than that.
An overnight sort of thing.
You would come in and stay overnight, and then start in the morning. Mm-hmm. If you weren't done, they would stay.
Have dinner with the guys before the night before, sort of.
Right. Yeah. Yes. And we usually finished up in the course of a day. Mm-hmm. But they were not scattered around the country. I did get them to have a board meeting out here.
Mm-hmm.
When I was chairman.
Okay.
I said, hey, why do we have to meet in New York City at the Roosevelt Hotel? All of us know what the inside of this place looks like. I said, let's go out to Salt Lake to Snowbird.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll get you a place where you not only can have a fine meeting, it won't cost you as much, even as much as it does in New York City, and you can see a beautiful, beautiful spot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after a pitch like that to guys who were sitting in the Roosevelt Hotel, great! So the next meeting was held out here.
Mm-hmm.
And they did hold a few at other places. They held some in California and stuff.
Mentioning California, it's when you were a little earlier, you were one of the people pushing to get the conference, I think, to set up California operations. Was that an easy sell or a hard sell?
It was an easy sell because we had used almost all of the small colleges in New Hampshire that could have done an adequate job of this. They have since gotten a few more schools involved, and several of them are not very good. The schools they had in New Hampshire were excellent. But some of those schools, like New Hampton School, Rooster Academy, these gave us up.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've had to find other places. And this Salve Regina is, I don't think it's as nice a place to have a meeting at Newport as it was at Rooster Academy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's where it is.
Mm-hmm.
But Brewster said they didn't want us.
I want to go with the board for a minute. As I read the minutes, I see this curious, what appears from the minutes as a sort of curious issue that there's discussion of finances and whether the fee can be raised, but in fact the main problem seems to be that the reserves are always growing.
Yeah.
Was that your sense of the background reality?
Well, not at that time. When I was chairman of the board, we weren't so flush. What they have done is they've expanded the base tremendously. If each conference contributed, let's say, $5,000 to the overall operation, if you get 50 new conferences, it goes up. And they have tried to distribute more of that to chairs, conference chairs, but there's a limit. They don't want to give these guys unlimited resources either. So if they want more, they want to have them raise it. I don't think it's been a serious problem, but it's been a problem where you don't want to accumulate large amounts of dormant money, because that then will attract the attention of the IRS very much. And we didn't want to get us in a bad spot with the IRS.
But in fact, the first with Parks and then with individual conference fundraising and the charging of fees that go into a central pot, one way or another, it seems to me these are very successful financial mechanisms, if you will.
That's what I was doing yesterday. I don't understand why. I find it very hard to raise money from industry or anybody else. But all of these things that related to the Gordon Conference have been, even in the Gibson Island conferences, these guys could say we need $40,000 to pay for this house on Gibson Island. And they went to 40 people and they got the money.
Mm-hmm.
Gordon did.
Yeah.
And it's a mystery to me how he did that. But he was a master at that. Mm-hmm. And Parks was pretty good at it.
And Cruikshank pushed it away in some way, too.
Yeah, well, Cruikshank didn't feel that he had to control it all so tightly. It was much more, like a Boy Scout troop. With Cruikshank, he had everybody doing their part. He had rules of which he made them follow. He kept a decorum in the operation. And he encouraged them to use their resources to further the good of the conference. And maybe one of the things now is if they're getting too much money, they ought to begin to subsidize and call in more industrial speakers. Mm-hmm. I noticed in last year that there were a lot of more industrial speakers, and some of them were good, mm-hmm. very good.
Mm-hmm. If you go just, we didn't, the present era, the Carl Storm era,
mm-hmm.
You mentioned the kind of the systems in the office. What else would you say about the characteristics of of this last era?
Storm has taken these international conferences, right, he's embraced them.
Mm-hmm.
They were done and they were limited earlier. But Storm, when he got in, he has embraced these, and they have flourished.
Mm-hmm.
Alex was opposed in that by some people. Basolo was one who opposed him on that. But Storm has embraced it, and lots of people, particularly abroad, like it. And that, I guess, has contributed some to the success of the conferences. It's getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Would I be correct in understanding that any Gordon conference anywhere these days has participants from anywhere in the world, but the majority of the participants may come from within relatively close range,
miles,
wherever you are.
Miles. I think that is probably true, whether it's the majority of a big part of them. That, for example, if we have a conference in New England, you'll get a lot of people from Union Carbide, DuPont, the areas that are 500 miles away from the New England. Most of these guys can drive up in their cars, and it doesn't cost so much, and the companies like it. On the other hand, you can get conferences out on the West Coast. There will be fewer of these people, or usually be a few that they send, even if it's very expensive, but not a lot. So it's just the economics, I think, that controls it. The thing that's bothering them is they're not getting enough industrial people. It's becoming more an academic, we love you session.
Yes. What if, has the inorganic conference been overseas?
No. We've had a lot of overseas people, haven't
we? Yeah. So the overseas conferences, what differentiates whether a conference is overseas or not?
Well, frequently, if somebody overseas wants to organize a conference, and he can talk somebody in the United States being a co-sponsor with him to deal with Alex, or with Carl now, and they can work together to get a conference organized over there.
If today's chair of the inorganic conference, has to raise some money. Is that true?
I don't think there's anything in the written documents which require that. But if he wants to raise, to present a program which will, one, attract a sizable audience, which, two, will present very good science, in which, three, will be well evaluated by the conferees, I think he has to raise money. It's just the way it is.
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing that's interesting is, and this speaks to the academic side, and there's almost a sort of peer review, peer esteem aspect.
Oh,
built
yeah.
into this.
That's right.
You don't want to be chair and bomb.
That's right. In fact, we've had a couple of chairs who didn't do anything until the end, and conferences were canceled, and it was not good.
Mm. But it's not clear that that would harm my industrial career quite as much.
Well, I guess the two people that I have here